Live from the Pathway Studios in Johnston proper, you are Live from the Path.
I am a working man, I get things done. Work for the Holy Ghost, work for the Son.
On this festive holiday evening.
Hey, I've got a question.
Okay, let's have it.
How long have we been doing this thing?
Let's see. It'll be 6.5 years.
Holy moly. I was looking at the intro thinking, you know, some of us have aged.
Yeah, that's true. What were we looking at? Was it last week, Mike? We were watching, so we've got like 1 year and 2 year compilations of the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I mean, Booba looks ridiculous.
Yeah, he does.
Like 40. Like, well, and so I say that meaning he's the most obvious change.
He's like 12.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he looks like we stole him from like a
Pampers box.
Yeah.
Or we got some candy in the van. Hey.
Come on to this internet radio. Yeah. No, yeah. We did notice that in the video. People certainly look different. And actually, I've noticed that my brows are getting bigger.
Huh.
Like year over year. It's hard to have video evidence of the changes of your life, like week over week. But I feel like my eyebrows are starting to go way Vagoda on me.
I mean, that's something to watch out for, I guess. I mean, the daily look in the mirror, I guess, it would be so subtle you wouldn't notice.
That's what I'm saying. It creeps up on you. You don't have any idea until you start putting it side by side.
You need to get the trimmers.
My wife keeps saying, let me pluck them out. Have you guys ever agreed to that?
No.
No, I didn't either. I said, this doesn't seem right. She says, you trust me with like your deepest secrets and times. And I'm like, yeah, but I just know, I don't think I can permit this.
I have a little pair of scissors I keep in my medicine cabinet that every once in a while I see one wanging, you know, I'll just cut her off.
Is it wrong to take a pull of it?
I pull my ear hair.
Ooh, ouch. That just seems terrible.
Yeah. It's not having it.
Yeah.
I had one stray hair growing out of the top of my nose a couple of weeks ago, and I'm like, what are you doing?
Well, yeah, what are those? Every once in a while, I'll be like, what?
Where did that come from, and why? Like, what purpose are you serving, Mr. Lone Gun, up there on top of the nose? You know, I see you don't have any friends with you like you're supposed to be there. It was weird.
I got one of those little trimmers for stuff like that.
Yeah.
My ears, yeah.
It seems like you got to put a lot more effort into it nowadays, you know? Like, after, you know, basically stuff was supposed to where it was supposed to be. Circa 5-10 years ago, and now it just kind of does whatever it wants.
I think you hit, what, about 28, and things start going sour?
Yeah, like your ear hair starts growing, and then that crazy one will come up on top of your nose, and you're like, why are you doing this to me? You know, I just want to grow a legit beard.
All right, you've been listening to Live from the Path. Here's what we got going on the show tonight. Dan is back from Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Sounds like a cool trip, so we're going to catch up with him, find out, I don't know, what that was all about, his takeaways from the trip, what it means for how we can react to situations in the world and what that means for, the local ministry, after kind of engaging in that interaction with folks. So interested to hear about Dan's time in Zimbabwe. Also, we're going to catch up on, last week's, Good News Changes the World. So the thought was, is that if the gospel is to change the world, are there tangible ways in which that could be reflected in some of the prime discussions of the day? Last week, our topic was healthcare. And so the question is like, if I ignore everything else and just relook at the situation through a healthcare lens, through a gospel lens, and say, what could this look like? And in what ways that we're able to control can we interact with this? And so I have a couple things I wanted to touch on from that, an article this week that I thought was interesting, if maybe right, maybe not. But anyway, I thought we'd talk about that, and then next week we'll introduce our next Good News Changes the World topic. And our goal really is to not only engage in this conversation, but find people that are trying to solve the problem through that lens, or at least interact with it, hopefully locally. And then we're gonna try to talk to them and say, like, how is that working for you in the realm that you can control? How does good news help shape the world and change the world in tangible ways that a lot of people are arguing about? So anyway, that's kind of the goal with that. We'll touch on that a little bit, and then next week we'll kind of move on to the next topic and see if we can find some people to discuss that with us. And we'll keep dragging some folks in here that we can find interacting, to get some more information.
Yeah, that's cool.
Okay. Okay. So I think then we got some advice on Dear Life in the Path.
Yeah, it looks like a freshman then going into college is trying to decide what she's going to do in the year in between, and the mom's trying to decide whether she wants to stick her nose in it.
Oh, ooh, okay.
So, stuff's up for discussion.
I feel like we should get in on that.
Yeah.
I think we'll be experts.
Yeah, that's no doubt about that.
I've parlayed both times.
Okay, well, so Dan, tell us, it's the first time you've been able to talk to you since you've been back. Tell us a little bit about the trip. Like, why did you go, and like, was there an organization involved, or what was the trip about?
Right. Gosh, where do I start with this whole thing? I connected with a group called Hippo Valley Christian Mission. And it's really because a guy I only knew through Facebook passed away. And he was like a moderator of a group that I'm in. And they were talking about how he was a great guy and everything. And of course, everybody says that, you know, when someone dies.
Right.
You know. And I thought, let's start kind of snooping around thinking, oh, he really was kind of a cool guy. Anyway, in his honor, they started Hippo Valley Christian Mission, had a scholarship fund set up where for $100 you could fund a Bible college student in Zimbabwe, tuition, room, and board for a month.
Oh, cool.
And I thought, man, $100, that's like, it's way better to train them there than for me to go there, you know, and be like Mr. Missionary guy, you know.
Sure.
Always go with the indigenous people, right? And so I did that for a little while, and then I just kept snooping around. We actually had the stateside director come out to our church and kind of introduce the whole ministry to us. And they have this Living Proof program, which is a sponsorship, kind of like your Compassion, you know the different ones out there. But it's a lot smaller. They have like a total of 1,500 kids. So it's a much smaller organization. There's practically no overhead, you know. It's just a handful of people doing this. And $20 a month, and you get them into their – this Hippo Valley has Christian schools. Within each school, then they'll start a church – and kind of spread out from churches from there. They'll plant new churches, and they have some medical clinics. They have an orphanage, the Bible college. They're just doing all this stuff. And I started listening to this guy when he came to speak to us, and I started corresponding. And they're like, I mean, it's not one of those missions where you like they just kind of keep happening and you don't hear anything really productive. It's like they're just like growing like crazy. They're reaching kids. There's thousands of children coming to their schools and their churches, and they're discipling these kids. I mean, and it's they're taking them out of the rural areas where no one's going and nobody cares about. And I was just totally excited about this. So we have like I think 30 families from Pathway that sponsor these Living Proof children.
Yeah,
and anyway, last November at a convention, a missionary convention, I had a face to face and said, "Dude, I want to go out there. I mean, I want to see. I think that's the responsible. If we're going to pour this kind of cash in, because then the church also started putting a lot of cash in it, so we're putting a pretty good chunk of change into this Zimbabwe deal." And I thought, I want to see firsthand. You know, is it legit? And you can make, you know, a good salesman can make anything look good. And so that was really part of the plan of me going out there. Also, it was my daughter Shanna and I went. It was kind of a scout team because we're going to have another team go next year. So we jumped on with a separate team that was already formed. And the purpose for this trip, a little context, the Living Proof program, the sponsorship, and all the schools they have spread throughout Zimbabwe, once a year they have a conference where all these teachers come in that are part of that program, and the pastors from those churches that are in the schools, they come in, and it's a training and encouragement, and kind of like any conference, you know, it's like a shot in the arm, like, hey, what you're doing is really, really important. You're changing the future of Zimbabwe, and if these children, changing their eternities. And so it's a thanks for what you're doing. Go out and do it with excellence. Go out and do it with everything you've got. And so I liked that, too. So it wasn't like it was, again, the indigenous people doing the work, but we were encouraging them.
Do they speak English?
The more rural you get, the less they speak. They I think it's called Shona.
Huh.
So it most like the songs, we never knew what they were singing. Unless we get some interpreter to give us, you know, some hints. The more toward the larger towns, they spoke pretty good English. We could communicate with a lot of people pretty well. And then we always had interpreters with us if we were, like I went to a church and preached and we needed an interpreter.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask, is like if you ended up having to, preach or talk to somebody, like if you had somebody just repeating everything you said.
Right. I did that. But at the first thing I spoke at this conference, And they did not need an interpreter because these are all the teachers and the pastors, and they're more educated.
Yeah.
And they knew English. I did have a tendency to speak kind of fast. I was a little excited, I guess.
No, I understand. Yeah.
I'd be like, okay, sorry, I'm talking too fast. They'd look at me like, yes, 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 you're talking too fast. And
did you? I mean, Dan, is that your first? Is that your first interaction with an interpreter, like someone interpreting what you're saying?
You know, it's funny. People have asked me that, and I don't remember.
Oh.
In China, I think I it had been Taiwan. I believe I did. But it's one of those things that it must have went okay because, you know, it's just like there was nothing special. You just speak a little slower and they say that sentence, you know, and you go back and forth. So it wasn't like a traumatic, you know, oh, an interpreter. It's just.
I mean, did you have any interaction where they spoke quite a bit longer than what you said and it made you nervous?
Yeah, there were times I kind of wondered, what's he really saying? Is he trying to get to what I, you know, trying to get to the point of,
right.
of whatever the sentence was? But he's actually a guy I know. It's crazy. It's a small world. Zebedee is his name. And I've known him for 30 years. He didn't know me and I wouldn't have looked at him down the street and said Zebedee. But when we met in Zimbabwe, I'm like, dude, I know you. You know, it's like I've seen you at the conventions and
right.
he's spoken at conventions and stuff. The missionary conventions. So yeah, that was kind of cool. It's like now we're like buddies. But, anyway, that was the first part of the trip was the conference. That was like 2.5 days. And, we had a professor, a college professor with us who teaches education. So they did some education, creative education things for the teachers. And we had several school teachers there that could kind of share some of their experiences. A couple of us were pastors. So it was a good mix of a team. Then we did a couple of vacation Bible schools where we went out into the schools, the rural areas, and everything's at least a 2-hour drive. It might be 20 miles, but it's 2 hours because the roads are that bad. It was insane. I can't even begin to describe, and no one could have described it to me until I got in there. And you're bouncing. I mean, you're literally going up and down the hills within the road, the flat road.
Right.
We even had a tire fall off once. That was fun.
Wait, it just fell clean off?
It fell off. And it, and we were like in the middle of nowhere. And I'm thinking, okay, we're in Africa. I don't know. Is there a lion over there? I mean, I was like.
I don't know.
So I'm like walking down the dirt road.
My mind says jackal.
Yeah, exactly.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, yeah. Elephants. So I'm walking down this dirt road looking for lug nuts. And we found them. They were like about a mile.
Oh, man.
A mile.
Crazy.
but I tell you what, the vacation Bible schools, they're insane. We had 1,500 kids between two schools. The first one was closer to town. It was still rural, but they spoke English pretty well. They interacted pretty well. The second school we went to was more rural, and they were a little intimidated. Some of them have never seen maybe white people.
Right.
I mean, it was under British control just 20 years ago, but a lot of them have left. And so there's not just a lot of white people around. And so especially the kids, probably they may have never seen one. And then, you know, when you're the size of Goliath walking around. I remember I got out of the car and took a step, and the whole entire crowd of children took a step back.
That had been awesome.
It was awesome. All the guys were like, man, I wish I had the video camera going.
Hey, it's funny to think that, like, when your car broke down and you were walking down the road, like, if you were run into a child, they would be more worried about a Dan Hudson than a jackal.
Exactly. Oh, that's my friend Bob, the jackal.
What is that? That's great.
Oh, so it was fantastic. These people are full of grace. They're full of joy. They have nothing. You know, they're literally living in grass huts and with grass roofs. And have no money, they're living off the land, and they've got nothing, and in a really a pretty oppressive government,
right?
And yet they'll break into song, and their eyes brighten up, and they smile like nothing. I mean, they're just excited to be alive, and that was just kind of cool to see that, and to be a part of that. They're really intentional about training children how am I saying this? Like, okay, my first impression was the teachers and the pastors.
Yep.
And the thing's about to start, and somebody just starts singing, and pretty soon they're all standing up and they're clapping and they're dancing, they're smiling, they're just worshiping and loud. You know, this may be 60. It's not like a huge, you know, I mean, it's not that many schools, right? And it is loud and in full harmony and just gorgeous. I have no idea what they're singing. And it's kind of an echo thing. Like there'd be a couple gals that would lead a thing and everybody would kind of repeat it. And it was just kind of cool. I thought it was just neat to experience that. And then they'd be like a really, do I say primitive? I don't know. Kind of, a djembe that they made out of something,
right.
You know, and that'd be like their only music, you know. So I saw that for 2 or 3 days. Then we went to the vocational Bible schools, and then I witnessed it, like in they're obviously training the younger generation to do that, because those kids sing and they clap and they're on. I mean, they're on, and I just noted just the way like the girls did something or the teachers would do something, and the people would echo that they were totally training what they're going to do as adults. Yeah. And then I saw an older crew, high schoolish, went to an orphanage. And there was a whole mixture of the kids there, and I saw like the high school girls leading some music, and I thought, man, that's like a mini version of what we saw before. And it was just kind of cool to think they totally train them from childbirth on how to celebrate life and sing and worship, and I thought, man, we missed that out. We don't do that.
That's true.
I mean, we do our attempts, but it's a cultural thing. We're just a bunch of deadbeats, though. I mean,
right? Well, it seems like it's more ingrained in the culture where we're like trying. We don't even know how to quite do it right.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, right? Like it's not for lack of effort or lack of desire or even a thought that we are missing out on something. I feel like there's just something that is a block there where I personally don't know how to, I just know how to do it.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Is it like we have too much to have inherent joy, right? Like we'll fill where joy belongs with something else.
I don't like that song.
Yeah, right.
Right? You go, I mean, you look even, you know, most churches, like, I mean, there could be some churches that are getting down on the worship, right? And like, all, you know, in comparison, it's gotta be like, you guys are this is amateur hour.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? People are drinking coffee, half interested. One guy's got his hands up. That dude digs it. But the rest of them are like, hey, you know, get on with it. You know, and these guys, like, this is the main event. The main event is we're here to worship, you know, like that would be so cool to see and be a part of, even if a little bit convicting to me, because you need it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't mind being convicted in a way where I should be ashamed of myself.
But, you know, even at that, the conference, they only see each other once a year, right? Right. So even they would like pull out their phones and take video because it just sounded so good.
Right.
You know, and cause they're used to with singing with the kids, you know, and their churches. We did a church and it was the same thing. You had the younger and the middle and the older singing and you can just totally see, like I say, they're training their kids from when they can first speak. This is how we do life here. And that, I really was impressed with that. I don't know how to duplicate that because it's a cultural thing. Like you say, I mean, it's, you know, we can say we're going to do that at our church. Well,
Dan fires up a primitive chant to no reaction
by himself.
That sounds like Lion King. Well, maybe it is.
Good luck, Hudson.
Oh, yeah.
So based upon the things that you've kind of talked about so far, I guess maybe that was the next logical question is like, does it change anything for you? Like as you're riding on the plane back and you're digesting the stuff, you're talking over it with Shanna, right? Like, and you think just in our circumstance versus their circumstance or anything, like, what are some of the takeaways that you had that you think are like appropriate to at least see differently or do differently or look at differently, at your ministry here at home?
Right. Well, part of it for sure is, we've been having a lot of budget conversations with my family of not even necessarily like adding things to the budget, but just like, what can we get rid of that we're just really, it's just, why are we spending this money?
Yeah.
You know, and like, we're going to start sending 100 or 150. We haven't figured that out yet to, particular, we've adopted a church, there, the one I preached at.
Yeah.
I got more of the story of the church and I thought, man, I just want to walk alongside these guys and we could be their sister church. And so that's where we're going to go back and visit them next year in July. But I'm going to send them 100, 150 bucks, whatever, and that's going to like revolutionize them. We don't want to just throw money at them, but I also want to make sure the preacher's being paid enough and they're having the funds to do what they need to do to function.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so that he's not out there trying to figure out, man, how am I going to feed my kids? You know, it's like, I want to make sure you're fed and you're taken care of. We're not talking big dollars. I mean, at top, they're making $500 a month. I mean, that's a good living wage there. They're getting paid $300 right now. And so I'm going to add to it to get them, bump them up a little bit. So that's just a stress. Really, it's more of just a stress relief off of him. Because Zebedee, my buddy there, said he was very impressed with how this guy has been working. I figure he knows. What do I know? You know,
right.
I'm there for a week or for an hour.
I mean, how can you not trust a man named Zebedee?
I know. You know? I mean, it just sounds trustworthy.
Yeah, it does.
So yeah, we're looking at, like, I have a storage unit that I've had probably for 4 years, and it's been at least 2 years since I've been in it.
Right.
You know, I'm like, and they keep raising the rates. It's like 150 bucks a month now, and I'm like, I don't even know what's in it.
Yeah.
Well, that needs to just go, you know, because right there is the 150 bucks.
There it is, right.
You know, that doesn't even, like, I'm not even sacrificing.
It's like a perfect metaphor, right? Like, here's all the stuff you're holding on to that could be there to benefit somebody else. And you're like, man, that speaks pretty plain.
I mean, that's literally a life changer for them. And for me, it's just like, it's 150 bucks.
I like grumble, that stuff, grumble. I think. I don't know.
So, you know, there's that, you know, looking at, I mean, I don't like feel guilty that we have air conditioning. I don't feel bad for our culture. I thoroughly enjoy living here. So that's not a thing. But I think of how little it would take, a little effort on our part to really, revolutionize, you know, them. I laid there one night. You guys know me. I'm not like a Mr. Weeper guy, right? I don't sit there crying. I'm just weeping. I'm just like, I'm glad everybody's in bed and I happen to wake up and I'm just laying in bed. I'd always put the blanket over my head and I'd do my little Facebook posts and stuff, you know, so I wouldn't wake anybody up. And I'm just sitting there weeping. I'm like, what the crap? What's going on here? And I was having this heart to heart with God. I said, God, I will, if you want me to, I'll move here. I mean, this is, you know, I was having a big enough connection with the people. I was like, I was basically just, I guess, making sure I could verbalize to God, I'm letting go of everything.
Right.
You know, I mean, I plan to retire from Pathway Church in Johnston, Iowa. But if you want me to do Zimbabwe, I'll do it. In our little heart to heart, he was kind of pointing out budget things for me, like, well, dude, you know, you don't know the language. Why? I mean, don't waste your time.
Right.
I got people here who know the language of the culture, the nuances of all, you know. Yeah.
All the kids are afraid of you.
Yeah, exactly. You're a beast. Stay in America.
There's a poster of you right now on a village wall. A very crude drawing.
So, yeah, I mean, that's probably the biggest way that I've since returning have really evaluated, like, as far as change that I need to make. I need to simplify my life and be more generous and be more. We can impact some people with very little effort.
Yeah,
you know.
I had that conversation. I think we were talking about it within the last few weeks, just out of some Bible study. And it was like what we run into is, I think, is folks feeling guilty about wanting to do gospel work and feel like they're making a difference in people's lives. And they're like, well, you know, am I supposed to sell everything I own? Am I supposed to like live in a smaller house and whatever? And I said, like, and one of the things to react to that is to say, sometimes, like, you don't need to move to a third world country. There's people there, but you can come up with $200 way faster than they can.
Yeah.
It's okay to be the resources, man.
Right.
If money is easy here, then distribute it easy, right? Like, if you can get it faster than they can, if you can help them build a well, if you can help them, you know, fund a pastor, if you can help them feed children, you could quit your job and go over there and take another share of the crops and sympathize with them, or know that, like, you can get money very, very easily. And as much as we can get blinded by it, we can also, like, if we use it correctly, to do very, very cool gospel things throughout the world. Thank the Lord he's put you in a place where you can get easy money. Don't keep it.
Right.
Right? Just the distribute. But, like, it's okay. It's a right use of resources to say there's a lot here. I will take a lot, and then I will distribute it out.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And I think something that we I think there are a lot of times when we approach scripture, like, we do people grasp and say, look, I will give all this up if I have to, or if God wants me to. And, like, a lot of times God is saying, no, I got you in a place where you can procure cash.
Yeah, right,
do it.
Right. Yeah.
Do it and send it to somebody who really needs it. Like, they don't need any more sympathy or a guy that can, I mean, hug them while they are starving. Just fix the starving problem with the money you have.
Exactly.
All right, all right. So I was looking it up. In case anybody's interested, you can go to hippovalley.org/living-proof. Or there's a link to Living Proof on the front page of hippovalley.org. And you can get in on the Living Proof sponsorship program. It's $20 a month, and it goes directly towards the evangelistic efforts within the 27 mission schools and toward the forming and operating of the Living Proof clubs. And that was focused on Bible learning and leadership development. And I think that's a cool thing, like reflecting on the stuff that Dan had talked about. Is, you know, not only is there obviously good work going on, but like, there's a right thinking that you need leadership, right? Like, you need to be right. able to train folks, you need to be able to, so that stuff can keep going, without trying to go in and break up the culture. You use the culture as it sits and otherwise provide some direction for it and then let it ride. And so mm-hmm. that's pretty cool. You can get it on that for $20 a month. The kid, they'll take some of the money to fund for like future education. It costs to go to high school. You know, and the fees, I remember there's a guy, like, we were sending money to Pakistan, to help with some kids that are in, that are low income there. Cause like, they have uniforms there. Like, you have to own the uniform to go to the school.
Yep.
Even
yep.
in rural Pakistan.
Yep.
And so like, you gotta buy the uniform. They need books and stuff. And like, no one's providing that. If you don't have it, you don't have the books or you're not allowed to go to the school. And so, like, a very small amount of funding allows five kids or whatever to be able to go to school that month. And so, like, part of what they do with your $20 is they put it aside, in an account to be able to help with high school fees and additional education down the road, scholarship opportunities. Then they get a Bible and a shirt and, yeah, all kinds of cool stuff associated with that. So that's $20 a month. You can get in on that. That's hippovalley.org, /living-proof.
Tell you, it was really cool. We were at one of the schools where a couple that we were in our group was sponsoring a child there. And, the teacher brought the child to them just so they could meet, you know, and cause, you know, they've been praying for him and they brought some gifts like shirts, you know, the socks and things like that. And, it was so cute. The couple was sitting in a chair, two chairs, and the little girl came up and kneeled down and said, "Thank you for my shoes and thank you for my uniform." And she started listing off a few things and, you know, of course they're just in tears like, "Oh, sure. You're welcome," you know, and, I was sitting right next to him, so I even got that on video form, cause I thought this is gonna be a kind of a neat moment, you know?
Yeah.
And, it was just pretty neat, being a part of that. But I did not get to see the child we sponsor. He's in a different school that wasn't very far away, but again, it would have been like a 2-hour drive.
Right.
And that's the day we lost the tire when we were in that area, and it was like, yeah, it's just not gonna work, so.
Yeah.
They went to orphanage that night, so we would have, you know, would have missed the orphanage. It's crazy. They have, there's all kinds of different things. Like, there's the Living Proof that sponsors a child. There's the orphanage. I think it's $100 provides their room and board and food and education and everything. So there's all kinds of, if people like want to sponsor a particular project or person
yeah.
or, you know, type of thing that they're pretty good at breaking stuff down like that. And like I say, we're adopting a church, cause I think, well, how else, you know, that's where discipleship happens. It's you're reaching the neighborhood and that community community in that area. So, it's so exciting to see things happening there. They're just happening. The Spirit of God is alive and well and spreading in that area. So.
Yeah, and there's also just check out the website. Go to hippovalley.org. There's a lot of all the opportunities that you can provide. You can travel. There's trip packages and stuff out there. Project ideas. There's a blog so you can keep track of kind of what's going on. And here's the thing. There's plenty of places that good Christian folks that are doing work in these areas. It is nice to connect with someone with something that someone you know has seen with their own eyes, right? Like, can validate mm-hmm. that the money's gone. Dan, you and I both heard, you know, stories from pastors or churches that have helped try to support something overseas. And yeah. like, it's a rook, right? It's a show. Right. And you wouldn't know the difference. The guys are good at it.
Right.
And so, being able to kind of go see and make sure everything is on the up and up. Unfortunately, where the good of God is, the deceit doesn't tend to lie too far around, mm-hmm. So they can poison what God's up to. So anyway, you know this. Dan went and checked it out, and looks good to go. So go to hippovalley.org and see what else is out there. Dan, I was going to ask you though. So you went to when you were in China, you went as a younger man,
Right.
Now having gone to the trip to Zimbabwe, like, can you compare those trips for me? Like, was there anything different? Was there anything different for you, not only about the cultures and the places and stuff, but like, mm-hmm. you as a person, what it was like when you were younger going to China, and like, was there anything different for you going to Zimbabwe now?
Maybe I was in my 20s when I went to China. It was China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. We went to some orphanages, and we were trying to create some relationships so they could ultimately adopt children back to the States out of China.
Yep.
Get them to Taiwan. And you're just younger then. I felt I had much more to give in Zimbabwe.
Uh-huh.
That could be because I'm older and more mature. It could be because the people are so receptive. We had to be a little more covert, especially in China.
Oh, sure.
We smuggled Bibles and things in, but we still had to be pretty careful. It was more open in Taiwan, and we were more. Our home base was an orphanage in Taiwan, and so part of it was just playing with the kids there who are already in a really great Christian environment. So the particular mission in Zimbabwe was much more outreach oriented. I mean, the people's there was more joy. There was more joy in people's eyes in Zimbabwe than in China. They were empty, and the communism had just beaten them down. You could just tell.
Yeah,
because we were in a rural area in China as well. There was a vast difference in the way people interacted. For sure, just the general population.
Yeah, sure.
In Zimbabwe, we would drive by and wave, and just the fact that we were, you know, white people and adults that were waving, the kids were they would squeal. I mean, they were just so excited, and they giggle and jump up and down, and oh, look at the white people! You know, the interpreters told us what they were, you know, saying, but it was a happy, you know,
right?
No, so it wasn't like freaky or. So we spent. I just drove down the road waving at everybody,
like a prince of the parade.
You know, exactly, exactly.
So, what did you teach on? Like, was it intimidating to walk into a culture like that, and like you were going to speak to them, change, or was it an easy thing? What did you teach on, and how did it go?
I did the same sermon at the teaching conference as I did at the church, because, you know, different crowd.
Yep.
And they had set the theme, arise and shine, if your light has come, in Isaiah 61. So we had to speak on that theme. So I talked about being light, in the world, basically making disciples, and just the Jesus said, you are light. Not try to be light, you just are. And so go out and be Jesus, you know, to people. And I think that's pretty universal, but it was intimidating. Thinking, I don't know, you know, just the little things. Like I had a little turkey hunting story because I did it here the week before we left.
Yeah.
And so I called my Zimbabwe connection. I said, do they even know what wild turkeys are? You know, I mean,
right.
I don't want to give them some big story, and they'll be looking at me like, what are you talking about? So that was intimidating, but they knew. What they are. But I did also, I had a wild turkey walk up to me at a school. I'm like, okay, in America, they see you 2 miles away, they're running. So that was different.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, but so they probably still didn't like my story. But the whole idea was the darkness, and then when the sun rises and everything new, you know, so that was pretty universal. But it was a little intimidating. But by the end of the trip, probably my best personal moment.
Yeah.
Was we had gone to a school. They have their morning devotions and chapels and stuff like that. Went to a school chapel service. This is right before we left, actually. And there's probably 600, 800 kids. I don't know. There's 900 kids in that school. And they filled the room. Whatever the room was, they filled it. And I had been with them enough to kind of get them a little bit. You know, they do a lot of shouting and repeating. And if you engage the crowd, they will engage you.
Yep.
And, you know, we talk about Proverbs and stuff a lot here. I thought, you know, I'm going to do the whole, you know, I had like a 5-minute preparation, right? Hey, will you speak? Sure. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do wisdom, you know, calls out from the street, you know, calling your name and from Proverbs 1 and 2. So I don't know. I started talking and I talked about my when I was a kid, when I was their age, and I'd be out playing, and my mom would call my name, and it was time for supper, you know, I'd run home, and I, you know, I said, well, I haven't heard that for years. Can I hear you say, Dan, come home, or and eat, or whatever I said, you know?
Yeah.
And it was so cute. I mean, it was like hundreds of kids shouting out, Dan, it's time to eat, you know? And I said, when I heard that, I heard it call my name, you know, I'd come running, and then I talked about my friend, I'd see him, we'd call each other's name, we'd go across the street and say hi. And then I had a dog named Puddles that didn't listen, and we would call his name, and if he saw someone across the street, he'd run out to say hi. And one time he saw someone, and we called his name, and he didn't listen, he got hit by a car and died. And so the kids were like, oh no, but you know, each time I had him yell out different things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I said, hey, you know, I read the verses. I said, wisdom is calling for you, you know. And it was just, anyway, I finally figured out how to communicate with him is my
right.
point. You know, I'm
right.
going way too far into what I said. And it was like totally connected with him. And it was just a neat, I'm glad on a selfish level that I got to experience that. Because I thought now when I go back next time, I'll have a different approach.
Right.
I kind of figured out a little bit, at least how to talk to the kids, so.
So it's a pretty good crowd for interaction, right? Like they're
yeah.
paying attention. They can respond back to you,
yeah.
and it sounds like they're kind of energized by that type of thing.
And they're totally narrative, which I had heard understood that, but it's like that they don't want, you know, a 3-point outline and four poems or something. They want a story,
yeah.
with a point and a movement and yeah. And I knew that, but I still didn't do well. I didn't feel good about my little sermon thing. But I felt pretty good. I felt way better about the devotion thing that I had no preparation on than I did the sermon I poured hours over, you know.
Well, I don't know. Based upon you're kind of right, like if it's a narrative thing, but that would make sense, right? Like,
yeah.
you put some structure into something, like, okay, yep, I get it.
Yeah.
cool. So, physically, I don't know, Dan, those are long flights. Was that, how'd those go?
Oh, buddy. So, yeah, we go from Des Moines to Chicago. That's what, hour and a half, whatever. Chicago to D.C., which was, what is that, 3, 2.5, I can't remember. And from D.C., to Ethiopia, that was like a 13.5 hours. And then there was another 4-hour into Harar, Zimbabwe. Then it was a 6-hour drive that we hadn't prepared for, through the potholes.
Right.
That was killer. That, we had died by then. It was actually worse on the way back, though. Because we went from Harar, the capital of Zimbabwe, back to Addis and Ethiopia. And then we flew, it was a 17.5-hour flight from Ethiopia to Dublin, where we stopped and refueled, but they didn't let us deplane. We just sat there on the runway for an hour.
Ooh.
And then on to D.C. And that was brutal. And I only got up once. I got once the whole time. I thought, you know, I should probably go to the bathroom at some point. And it was when we were stopped, and I was in line. It was about to my turn to go, and she's like, you have to sit down. They're fueling the plane. And I'm thinking, well, if it blows up, I mean, does it matter if I'm standing or sitting?
You know, that's true.
I wasn't sure about that.
At least I'd be comfortable.
Yeah, I'd be comfortable. And then that was, I mean, it's not like I couldn't. I mean, you know, you're in a plane. You can get up and walk around in those big old honking planes. But I just didn't. I was by the window. I would have to crawl over people, you know.
Yeah.
I just didn't. And I thought, that was pretty miserable. 17 hours just sitting in a 2-foot cube.
It's pretty bad. And you're right, though. Like the way back, Boo was not here, but he would have kind of had a similar experience, I think. When I went to the Philippines,
yeah.
It was about that. It was like 16 hours or so from Detroit to China. And like the first one's exciting, and you're like, I don't know, there's plenty of movies to watch. You're like, this is great. That ride on the way home was just awful.
Yes.
You think to yourself, I don't know what I was thinking. This is terrible.
Right.
I'll sleep in the aisle. I don't care what it takes. I need to get out of here. you develop it's not claustrophobic, but it's like, it's a weird sense. Because you have no control, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing you can do. You're over an ocean, and it's the middle of the night, and you got 8 hours, and you can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, it's just...
Can't sleep a wink.
Yeah, yeah. You're just up, staring around. Here's no wonder people go nuts.
Yeah.
You think, like, I sympathize with people who have trouble sleeping. Like, it just makes them erratic. And like, I don't know, it starts to give you a sense of, this would drive you crazy. You go 2 years of this thing every night? Wild.
Yeah.
Wildest. All right, so sleeping all right, though, Dan? Did you have – wait, so we were talking a little bit before the show started. You had a hard time sleeping while you were there.
Yeah. I chose the wrong bed. and it just wasn't a comfortable bed. I figured out later on I could put some air, not air mattresses, couch cushions on top of my, they're like two little 2-inch foam mattresses is what the mattresses are. Mm-hmm. And then it was on top of like some planks of wood that were separated by 6 inches or so. So it was just really uncomfortable the first couple nights. And the cushions helped, but they were like 2-inch cushions too. They're not like big fluffy cushions like maybe you have at home. So I had 4 inches of foam, which did help. It helped tremendously. But, you know, it's just, they're 7 hours ahead, and it just took me about a week and a half to get so I'd actually sleep all night. And that was about the time we turned around and came home. So yeah. It took another week and a half or so to get my bearings here. Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't sleep a lot.
All right. Well, Dan, it's good to have Dan back. Dan, it sounds like a really cool time. So would you say a recommended trip if people are thinking about something like that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're having a little information meeting on August 14th where we'll show pictures and stuff from the trip and then kind of talk about our plans for about this time next year, July, I think it's 11 to 21. We're going back and do some vacation Bible school stuff again. And yeah, so.
No, so I know I thought of a question when we were talking about that vacation Bible school. So, like, is this for people or kids that are at a particular school or something? Or do they like bus them in? Do they walk in? Like, do they come in from like around the villages?
Yeah. Now the ones we did a couple weeks ago were at the schools, so they had walked. Some of these kids walked 9 miles to school
a day.
A day.
Dang.
At least half of them don't have shoes. Hmm. So they're walking. Yeah. And of course, they're not sitting there whining about, oh, I don't have shoes. They just don't have shoes. I mean,
right.
It's just what the hell they are. So it is a big deal when you do the Living Proof thing and they get shoes because they do love the shoes once they get them. But, yeah, so they were kids at the school. We just basically took over the school. And I don't know if other people came for that day because they knew we were coming or I don't know the background, but I think they were just the students there. The one we're doing next year will be at a local church. Where they will reach out into the neighborhood and bring in children. And from other people's experience there, we'll probably have several hundred at that too. I was talking to a guy today who did one, I don't know, a couple years ago. And there are 80 people pre-registered and like 200 showed up and all these kids were like in the bushes watching and my friend's like, well, what are they doing? He goes, well, but they don't know what we're doing. They don't know what a VBS is. And he says, well, invite them. So he, you know, spoke the language and they all started coming in. Then all these adults, it turned into a revival outside. Basically everything that happened in the 60s really well in America.
Yeah.
Is really effective there.
Huh.
So revivals, VBSs, and he even said today, if you had a bus that you could take to Zimbabwe, they would grow like a weed.
Wow.
Because it just, everything that worked in the 60s and 70s totally works there.
Huh.
Yeah.
What's the spiritual climate in Zimbabwe? And you don't have to speak for the whole country, but like at least in
well,
the
I'm
area
an expert
that you're in.
Now.
Things that I've been there recently.
it is, this was a little surprising to me. It is very denominational.
Uh-huh.
Like there were some pretty fancy Catholic buses driving around.
Oh.
And I don't know if that was for locals or Catholics that were coming and traveling. I don't know about that. So everything there is it's big to be part of a club, to be part of a group. Some churches even have uniforms. Every school has uniforms.
Right.
So it's like I'm going to be the Methodist, you know, and they have the cool uniforms or something, then they'll be part of that group. And so they've been heavily This is my assessment, and I could be totally wrong here. Again, go back to America in the 70s, where there's lots of people going to church, but not everybody like really Jesus people.
Sure.
I think that's what's going on. And that's why people that – I think it's a pivotal time where the culture could slide and follow what we did, you know, or there are people very receptive to the gospel right now too. Which is, I guess, why I'm so passionate about going back and hitting this next generation because we can totally change that culture. Obviously, there's several who don't go anywhere to anything, but yeah, it's heavily denominational. But that's all I know. I mean, I don't know how deep those roots are.
Sure, yeah.
You know, a lot of times the denominations will send money overseas, and then when you get on the mission field, they're all like, whatever, we're just Jesus people. But I don't know if that's what it is there or not. I can't say from experience. So,
I heard a similar description of China from, like, there was a missionary that had written a book, and it was similar. He had gone to jail, and things were going real well. It was like it was more of a grassroots effort. They were it was Brother Young. And so, like, they're part of the Back to Jerusalem movement. Like, we're always like, hey, we're gonna go to these people groups and help them meet Jesus. And the Chinese Christians are like, hey, somehow between here and Jerusalem, things have gone awry. We're heading back. And we're gonna evangelize on the way back to Jerusalem to make sure the whole path is kinda taken care of. So anyway, he said he'd gone to prison, and like 7 years later, he came out and he said, like, the whole communal aspect to it and the whole kind of, like, pure focus on Jesus had gotten a little bit jacked up because foreign missionaries started coming in and denominationalizing the areas.
Yeah.
And so then you got in an argument because, like, the groups, strong groups that tend to evangelize or, like, spend the money to send missionaries tend to be hardcore on theology. So, like, you had, like, Pentecostals and then Reformers who'd like poured into China, uh-huh. And now they're fighting over, hey, there aren't miracles like this anymore. And, like, the Chinese people who had seen some of these things are like, you know, they're no longer asking, do you follow Jesus or are you a Christian? They're like, what denomination are you? And the guy was pissed when he got out of prison. He's like, what happened when I was gone? Yes, we can use resources. Yes, we can use training. But, like, whatever happened here is culling the herd here. It's dampening the movement because of some of the things that people have now kind of changed their identity to be shaded by one thing or the other. So it was interesting hearing that from him. And it sounds like you run similar risks, I guess, anytime you start kind of pouring different ideologies in different places like that.
Yeah. You know, there is a pretty extreme Pentecostal vein going through the place right now to a lot of really hyper spiritual things. Like when I was speaking at my conference thing that I was at, there was a church, I think they figured out it was about four blocks away, that was so loud you could hear the preacher. I mean, he was just screaming the whole time. So who knows what he was saying, but I thought it was like someone across the street, like a drunk or something, but it was actually a church.
If he was hopeful, it was a Pentecostal. If he was upset, he was a Southern Baptist.
Yeah, exactly. It was, and it was kind of overpowering our little conference because we didn't have any sound systems or anything. It was just, you know, a group of 60 people or something.
Right.
In a little brick building. But, that's going on. There's some, I don't know if I want to use the phrase "new age," but ultra spiritual, not Jesus stuff going on too. I wish I would have taken pictures of that. I didn't because I didn't want to take too many obvious pictures driving down the road. Because they have like little turbans on and stuff. They're not Islam or anything like that. It's some spiritual religion thing, and they'll just camp out in like a section, like a lot, like a house lot, you know, a piece of ground along the road. And that just becomes their church gathering place. They'll never have a building or anything, and people will come there. And the guy I was talking to, Zebedee, was saying they will, if it can be typhoon season, and they're still going to be there, and they're going to be doing whatever it is they do, you know. And the people come, and like it's like really oppressive, too. And it's wild because like it's like, there's no money to squeeze out of these people, you know.
So what's it for?
Yeah. I mean, is it just I think it's a power trip for the people leading these. There's some type of guru guy or something. But like every mile or so, you saw another group, you know, going down the road.
I mean, you gotta appreciate their tactics, I guess.
I mean,
you know, I mean, at least they're hardcore.
They're hardcore.
You know, they're not half sold in.
Man, isn't that the deal though? It's like everywhere you look and you're like, those guys are jacked up. It's Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, Pentecostal power folks, some kind of weird spiritualist somewhere, but they're beating the streets.
Yeah,
they're spending
yeah.
time. They're spending money. They're causing people to follow them. And you're like, what the heck? Here's the deal. Evil is motivated.
Yeah.
I don't mean to lump that whole group as evil, but you understand what I'm saying, right?
Right.
Like evil is motivated, to work harder, work faster, commit more resources than good. And that's, we're on the other side of the good, who are like, I can spare a few bucks here and a little bit, a couple minutes to help a guy.
As long as it's not inconvenient.
Right, right. And evil's, hot footing it.
Yeah.
They're looking for ways to pervert it before the good can get there. And so, and frankly, you sound like old news. You're not offering fancy cars. You're not offering any, prosperity. Like, you're just offering true things. And you're like, well, yeah, but we heard this lie and it's pretty tantalizing.
Yeah.
The prosperity gospel's pretty hot there, evidently.
Dang it, the Pentecost, I mean, here's the deal. They sent people everywhere.
Yep.
They generated a lot of money, and they said, meet the nations. I tell you this, you want a church that is willing to commit bodies and money to missionary work, it's freaking Pentecostals. I mean, they're excited about it. As much as I have places to disagree, I mean, those people are putting money at things.
Yep.
We're too late. We're lazy. I'm disappointed in me.
I mean, don't you think that after a while they look around in rural Zimbabwe and go, I don't know if this prosperity thing is the deal or not.
Here's the thing. Here's what you're offering. You're offering hope. Yeah. Right? It doesn't have to be happening now. In fact, the promise
it's
of
your best life now.
The promise that only works in America. Yeah. Right? So like, so think about it. Heaven is much the same, right? The kingdom of Jesus says, not everything will be perfect now. You might suffer. Your life is one of service to people around you. However, there is a point in time which everything flips on its head for good. And so, like, Christianity is kind of a later promise. It doesn't promise anything good, like, permanent worldly prosperity now. However, so they're playing off the same vein, though, as they're saying, people can still buy this and they can look around and see one guy that's wealthy and say, it's working for him. Everyone else still has the thing that they really need, which is hope. Even if it doesn't change in their life, that's how that can continue to work. And that sucks. Cause that means you're playing off, that's people are gaining power off of other people's hope and they're missing the point.
Here's a 2-minute history of Zimbabwe. Britain came in and decided, hey, we'll go ahead and take this land. They'll be our colony. So they took the land, they redistributed it all, gave the best land to their own people. The Zimbabweans got the leftovers. Now, that was unfair. It was terrible. It was awful. However, that was also, they were known as the breadbasket of Africa at that point. It was like 70s when they were known for that. I mean, they were growing crops like crazy. They were just extremely productive.
Yeah.
The revolution happens. I didn't say this earlier, did I?
No.
Okay. The revolution happens, and part of the whole thing is we're going to give you your land back. We're going to take this back the way it should be. I think it's 1980 or 82, 80. They kick out, the UK and a couple years go by and one of the generals is now the president. He's still there as the president. The military people come to him and say, hey, you thought we were going to get our farmland back. What's going on? Cause he had other things to do. And he said, well, the white people own it. Go get it. And so there was a lot of big bloodshed going on again then.
Right.
And people went in and took farmland and even people who bought it after the revolution, they still lost it. It's a big, big upheaval. Well, what happened was people who don't know how to farm took the farmland.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it absolutely tanked Zimbabwe. It absolutely tanked it. Now they're the poorest country on the globe. They even beat Haiti. They're the poorest country. They're completely non-productive. You can't even find cash. Someone went into a grocery store in a community we were at and bought, whatever, $8 worth of stuff, had a $20 bill. They had to open the safe to get change. They just don't have it. They don't have money at all.
Right.
They don't even know. I mean, no one knows where it went. Like, it all disappeared. Somebody's hoarding it somewhere.
Right.
But the whole economy has collapsed and because they're not productive. And so he's been saying all along, the president, well, it's the white people's fault. They're oppressive, blah, 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 blah. But they're just now, the people are looking around saying, wait a minute, there's no white people left.
Right.
So, I mean, is there a big initiative to try to get some of those farms back into production, or?
I don't know. I don't know how they would do that, because now they keep switching who owns the land and stuff, and now people have, it's been a generation and people.
Their daddy didn't farm, and they're like, I don't know how to farm.
I don't know how to farm. But mostly they're just all self-sufficient. We got a few goats and some chickens and a cow or two, and that's, I'm not feeding anybody else. I'm just feeding myself.
Export, why? We're good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're not business people. They're just poor farmers doing their thing.
All right. Hey, check it. Make sure you check it out. HippoValley.org And there's plenty you can learn up on, contribute to. And here's the deal. Go back to something we were talking about just a little bit earlier. I mean, you can read, you can listen to some of this stuff. You can read about how other people are living. And if one of your actions might be, I have too much, I should sell it all and go sympathize with them next door. I mean, I suppose if God is calling you to that, whatever. But like, the likelihood is that you have the access to resources that they could very much use. You can obtain wealth much faster and easier than those folks can. And so, one of the things you can start doing right now, which is akin to Dan's story, is, take a look at your landscape and say, what do I got that can help people that need it? And then find good places to put it. So whether that's, the Hippo Valley folks, there's plenty of organizations. I mean, check them out. Like I said, evil kind of foots, is hot foots it, gets in front of stuff like that. But like, plenty of good places to send money, to people that will get it, people that can really need it, and you can get it easier than they can. So before you book a plane ticket, before you, you know, decide that you're gonna move somewhere, why don't you look at the resources you have, and how you can use that to help other people.
It's funny that you say that, like, even about that $150 is like, I can't barely do anything in this town for $150. Like, change a situation, change a life, you know, get a program started or anything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And like, it's almost $150 is almost laughably wasted.
Mm-hmm.
And you send that same money over there and it produces in spades, you know, like it makes all the difference in the world. And you're like, man, you know, like, I mean, it just seems the one thing that like, I don't know. Maybe it's a culture thing, a society thing. Obviously, it's a economical thing, you know. But like the thing that we have, we can't do anything with. You know, we have money here, and it doesn't matter how much you throw at it; it doesn't seem to actually turn a difference. Like you know, but like you take that same money, what they have joy in nothing, and the money's actually the icing. You know, like it's the blessing it was intended to be. You know, and we're like, man, the stuff that we got here, we can't. It doesn't matter how big of a place that you get or how extravagant a VBS you have or whatever. You know what I'm saying? It's still the joy of Christ that does all the legwork. God does the growing.
Right.
You know, and so like, I don't know. It just occurred to me when Dan was talking about that. I'm like, that's true. We can get money if we need it. Do we need money? We need it, right? And then the same thing's like, if we needed to get a group full of dudes together and worship, boy, that's a tough pull. You know what I'm saying?
Dang like, it, me, Mike. That's true.
How many phone calls I got to make and how many schedules? Dang, I ain't going to make it. Or, you know, I got other stuff going. Or we don't have the right sound stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, everyone's bailing on it. Can't make it to the park. Or, you know, whatever. These guys are throwing it together with a couple five-year-olds. They can pull it off like nobody's business. And then, you know, we're like, but we got lots. We got money. And we're like, you know, I don't know. Even though, like, Dan said, you know, you don't want to come back home and be like, you know, this air conditioning's of the devil. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think that's the point I'm getting at, but like, it just seems like, I don't know, you get so far past something and go, man, I've missed it. To realize you're on the wrong train, going the wrong direction, still screaming about being on the right train, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's convicting.
I gotta find the podcast. I think it was a guy who had a sports talk show on HBO for a while. Is it Bill Simmons? It might be Bill Simmons. Anyway, he interviewed a guy who started a charity for, wells, digging wells. And like, the dude basically was like a rich something or other, young executive type, if I remember correctly. And then he goes on a weird bender, like alcohol, like driving drunk, he's got booze in his car, hot footing it to Canada or something. That's my word for the day, apparently, hot foot. And so, he has some sort of God experience. Like, the podcast kind of, runs over this, but like, the way the guy's talking about it, he's run into Jesus, and it's basically, you need to do something different. And so, the guy ends up using all his, I don't know, skills or whatever, to figure out how to start wells places. And here's the thing, is like, it doesn't just help people get clean water, it completely changes their economy. It completely improves their family lives because, like, you have women traveling miles and miles and miles alone, in multiple dangers, primarily from men in the area. But you know, like long places where they're not home with their kids or whatever because they're going to get water that will likely kill the children by the time they get it back to them. And so, like, listen to this guy talk about wells and like it was very little money. You know, like you could put a well somewhere for, I don't know, $1,500 or $2,000. Or there was a guy that 99.3 had out at the Chick-fil-A talking about filtration systems filtering water that they had available to them. And it was dirt cheap for like solar powered filtration that would run for 5 years and feed a village of 50,000 or something. And you're thinking to yourself, like, I'm solving weird problems here and like things that I can't make movement on. And it would take so little of what we have, to otherwise make improvement on that. Most of what Dan said wasn't about money, but I think the point though is that like as you look at folks who are engaging in a joyful relationship with Jesus Christ without that, and I think to Mike's point, we would have a hard time rousting up that type of enthusiasm culturally. Mm-hmm. I wonder if part of the ways that we get there is being able to give and serve in that way for other folks. In those types of situations, because if that might be one of our blindnesses, well then if we open our eyes and start to make the movement, then you know maybe that kind of gets you back closer to square one.
Yeah, and I think it's some of it is like we'll look at the thing and say, look, that's just not our culture, or I just don't do that. I'm like, what the heck, why not? You know what I'm saying? Like your culture is defined about however you act. That's how they define the culture. So you don't like it. You don't put the change on it.
I was born a stiff white guy. My daddy was a stiff white guy.
Yeah.
My family who came over on the boat were stiff white guys. We just don't do that.
I don't know how many times that I've said I just don't do stuff like that. Only to think about it 6 hours later, I'm like, why the heck don't you do stuff like that? What kind of idiot steps inside a quagmire of a hole and be like, yeah, I just step in holes and that's what I do.
I live in it.
I don't get out of holes. It's just not what I'm built for. You dummy. What do you mean? It's ridiculous.
All right. Anyway, like I said, hippovalley.org. Go check that out. Maybe jump on the train and find something you can put your money to. And here's the deal. If you say you don't have money, that might be true. But you're also looking at that in a relative context. I would look back at my life over the last 10 years and go, oh yeah, I just don't have money. I bet I can come up with something. Right? Like if I just look out at my landscape and figure out relative to what money might go to, I got it or can get it. I can Uber a couple nights a month and fund a well.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like there's options. Here's what would be funny. If friggin' Uber got overran by Christians looking to do charity work. Like all of a sudden you got 10,000 people over a tri-state area who are flooding Uber drivers, because they're like, we're building wells. We don't have us to get money. So we're going to drive two nights a week.
Yeah.
We could keep Uber or Lyft or whatever in business with charity work. It's just a thought. Jump on the wagon.
I thought about going back to Target and working 5 hours a week and that'd just be my Zimbabwe money.
Yeah.
And then I thought, I think I'm wasting more than that.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
So, anyway.
That's true, right? Like, you can always, I always try to solve my problem by, like, I'm going to add a job or work. I'm like, I can't do that.
Stop it.
As I snack on some donuts or whatever I just bought, and I thought, well, there's a dollar I probably could have saved.
Bummer.
All right. Anyway, you're listening live from The Path. Thanks for hanging out with us so far tonight. Hey, if maybe you have questions for Dan, you can shoot us. You shoot it to us, info@livefromthepath.org, and I can get it to him, and he can answer any questions that you might have or hook up with him on Facebook. He's easy to find. He's the big, white, scary Dan Hudson on Facebook. I think you'll be able to pick him out. So anyway, I'm sure he's got more information or can help with any questions you might have about the organization, about the trip. Or whatever, because I mean he's an expert. He's a world traveler. I mean we're talking China, Taiwan, Zimbabwe, Dublin.
Yeah,
there's not a place Dan Hudson has not been. There's an Inuit somewhere who hasn't heard about Jesus, but Dan's targeting him next. All right, shoot. So here's the deal, Mike. I think we're gonna have to hold hold healthcare till next week.
Okay.
Which is good anyway, because the guy I don't know. Did you guys have a chance? The article was long. Did either of you read it?
No.
I didn't either. I forgot about it. Then I saw it the other day. I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
And I still didn't do it.
That's okay. So maybe if you try to read it this week, I'm going to try to see if I can get a hold of the author and see if we can Skype him in. Because it'd be interesting to have him talk about it and be able to answer questions as opposed, because here's what we do. We always read an article from a guy and then we describe ways in which he's not got it right. And he's not here to defend himself.
Yeah.
So maybe I can find this character and he would be willing to come on and we can at least talk with him about it. Cause I think there's an interesting interaction. There was another, article on the same website and it was about, it was a slightly different website, but the conversation was being had there. And it's like the uprising of people who are using the word socialism in a way that makes someone from 20 years ago, throw up. They're like, you're throwing this around like this isn't an evil in the world. Yeah. And it was just an interesting conversation about how people view that word. and what its implications are. And then this guy was kind of part of that discussion. And then from there, I tied back to his discussion on healthcare. And it makes me think that some of the way we look at things comes from either negative or positive reaction to governmental structures. And that's what the exercise that we're trying to go through is supposed to help with, is to say, is there any way I can eliminate all that for now? And calling it a reality, like you have to deal with the political structure that's in place. But like, if nothing was here, what would gospel work look like in this arena? And then let's rebuild from that point of view and say, now I have to understand our government works like this, or these are the things we can influence. Now what can we do? And so I thought his voice was a very interesting one as part of that conversation. So I'll see if I can get – it's Matthew Loftus. Maybe I'll share the article this week and we can talk about it for next week.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. Mike, what do you got?
Dear Life from the Path, my 18-year-old daughter has just graduated from high school. She has now informed me that she's not going on to college like we had previously discussed, and becomes upset when we try to talk to her. Mm. My question is, should we let her make her own decision about this and pay for it for the rest of her life, or continue to push her into some kind of life skill set?
Wow. Well, that's your dichotomy of options? Was that the end?
That was it.
Oh. Wow.
From life skills.
I mean, are they paying for college?
I didn't say.
I mean, because if they're not footing the bill, I mean, is she living at home?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I mean,
that's a real dad thing to say. Be like, you're going to have to get some life skills.
It's a little cheesy. I mean, some people subsist as pickpockets. So, I mean, you're going to have to be more specific, I guess. I mean, she's an adult. I would say control the things you can control. If you have a stipulation to say, look, we're willing to allow you to continue to live here rent-free or for a minimal amount if you're otherwise doing this. If you're not going to do that, we totally understand. But it will impact your life in the following ways. You will not live here for free.
I don't know. It seems hard to me. I mean, I've been on this kick for a while that, like, if my child is passionate about something and it requires a college education, I think you should get it. If you're passionate about something that does not require a college education, I would not get it. I just don't see. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's been the last, 30 years of high school where they're, where they've got this big push is like everybody's got to go to college. And what you have is a bunch of people working, middle management, white collar jobs, pulling in 50 grand a year and have, $100,000 in debt.
Yeah.
For something that they don't even love doing. Like, I have a business associate's degree. I answer the phone at a customer service center, right?
Like, $12 an hour.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm not saying that there's not life experience there. There's not people to hang around with, but I mean, you can find community in a mission trip to Zimbabwe and get more done if your goal is to just answer phones at the call center and make decent money. But, I mean, you want to walk in there with, $60,000 in debt just to say that you went to college?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Like, I wouldn't prescribe college as necessarily an answer, right? And, like, that's actually the worst. It's the worst possible financial decision to say, I don't know what I want to do with my life. Maybe I should pay you 15, 20 grand a year while I think on it.
Yeah.
Right? I can think on it in a forest or something.
On top of the fact that you have no passion to be there at the moment, so like your meteorology grades are going to suck.
I can't think of a worse way to spend money.
No, yeah. I mean, seriously.
Well, yeah, and think about what it would cost you. Like, what do I owe? I think I owe like 30 grand in student loan debt. I've been paying that thing for the last 5 or 6, how long I've been out of college, 7 years maybe. I try to keep up with interest and stuff. I still owe them $30,000. I've made like no progress on it. And I think to myself, like, I wasted it. And so if you think, let's say you took 5 years off and did not go to school and tried to figure out what it is that you were going to do, and then went to school and like did it focused and got your degree if you wanted to, or you found something else to do with your life. Like, that's just as good as not wasting $20,000 to go sit in a classroom somewhere to try to make that decision.
Yeah.
I know you look at your time and you say, I got to get my life started. Well, like, your life started whether you're in college or not, right? Like, you got to look at your life a little bit more holistically than that, and recognize that, like, that's not a value proposition, is to make a decision while you're forking out big dollars. In fact, it already commits you to a trajectory.
It's too bad that Boov is not here to speak on this, because, I mean, he did something very similar. Like, he went into the working world, and then now he's going back to school to finish up his degree because he knows what he wants to do,
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, same thing's true for Shannon, right? Like, she's going to be dentist or whatever. You can work on people. You got to go to school for that, right? You can't be a side-of-the-road dentist, that bags groceries on the weekend. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
You can't do that, right? But, like, if your daughter's like, listen, I was going to go to college and I mean, we just hear her out, treat her with some respect. Try to look at her not as your 5-year-old daughter who's trying to explain to you why her room gets to be dirty and she don't have to put clothes on today. I mean, it's a different conversation. She's 18 years old. I mean, just try to take your dad hat off or your mom hat off for a minute and just talk to her like she's another human trying to level with you. And I think that conversation's got to go different, right?
I think she has a boyfriend.
You think it's a dude?
I think so.
Dad says get some life skills that don't involve that man.
Yeah, if that's... You think it's a hidden boyfriend or he just didn't want to bring it up in the question?
I don't know, but I think she has one. I think that's really the root of her issue.
Dan says mystery man is the real problem.
And maybe the dad just isn't smart enough to figure that out, or maybe, I don't know.
Maybe he didn't go to college. Blue-collar dummy.
Here's the deal. I feel like I was, I can't think of anybody else that, Mike, did anybody else in our family go to college?
No.
No. Yeah. And so, like, and as the guy that's done it, I don't know that I recommend it. Like, it's hindsight, I suppose, to say that. But, like,
did you go because there was a girl?
No. No. So here's why I went to college. I went to college because I was going to be a high school English teacher and you had to have a degree. Like you had to graduate, you go through the teaching program. The college I went to had like a 98% placement. So that like once you graduate, I thought at least I know it's a bit, I did 2 years at community college and then I did 2 years at Simpson, which is a private school and it's expensive. But like with a 98% placement rate, I thought like I'll have a job. And as long as I have a job, and I'm teaching and I'm doing what I like, okay, I think this will be fine. And then I went through the process. I got to the last semester and you were supposed to do your student teaching.
Yeah.
And so like the deal with the student teaching was, is they're like, well, you're going to work at the school during the day. And so I was working at the time. I was going to have to quit my day job. And I said, okay, but I'm paying you, I don't know what it was. It's like $5,000 or $6,000 for this semester. I said, what happens to that money? And they said, well, we keep it. I said, I'm not even taking any classes here. Who are you giving the money to? Like, you're not paying a teacher. Are you giving it to the school that I'm working for having to deal with me? And they said, no. And I said, well, this is ridiculous. Why don't you give it back to me? Like, stipend it back to me so that I don't have to work at the Taco John's at night while doing the schoolwork. I charge me whatever nominal fee you have to do to pad the pockets. I don't care. But, like, don't make me pay you $6,000 for nothing. Compensate the school, give some of it back to me, and keep some for yourself. And apparently it's not a bargaining item. They don't know. And so, like, I simply could not square with this. I thought, I'm not paying this. This is not a, I'm not going to do this. And at the same time, while I was kind of fighting through that, I found out, like, we were pregnant with our first kid. And I thought, like, yikes, I was going to have to take a pay cut to go teach high school English. And I thought, dang it. I don't mind that necessarily, but my wife, we were talking through and thought my wife was going to stay home. And I thought, well, shoot, man, now we're single income. I do better if I just stay in kind of the corporate space that I had started in, call center style at the beginning. And so I stayed there. I ended up graduating without the teacher's certificate, but I had like English degree, basically. It was English degree at liberal arts college. I mean, you can get that on the internet.
Yeah.
Arguing with people about what you think, how Mark Twain was racist or whatever. Like, I mean, there's plenty of options. and so I walked away from it and I thought, like, it wasn't a college experience. I was working. I was living, with my wife at the time, right? So, like, it's not like there was anything beneficial about this whole operation. It was just, I just owe them $30,000 and, to no really avail here. And so, but now here's the deal. There's a combination of circumstances where I can look back and then say, maybe I should have skipped it. That's not true for everybody. There's a lot of jobs that require a degree. I'm very lucky that I'm in the job that I'm in, that they will continue to promote me without a degree. There's a lot of companies that won't. They'll say, look, we don't care what your degree is, and you could be a botanist for all we care, but you have to have a master's degree to get X job. It's dumb corporate stuff, but like, it's what it is. So, like, I get it, but I just wonder, Mike Rowe's pretty big on this, the dirty jobs guy, talking about, like, there's just plenty of work out there, lots of it, for people who don't, in, like, trade schools, or people who don't have college degrees or don't need them. You don't need a college degree to do the work I'm doing. I could have saved a lot of money. So, anyway, it's not a one way or the other, right? It's just look at your circumstance and don't shade the conversation by saying, have to college or you suck.
Yeah, and don't skip college because of some dude.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see what Secular says. Secular says, your daughter may be burned out from studying. Rather than push her into doing something she is sure to resent, consider allowing her to take a gap year. This does not mean it should be spent resting on her laurels or her fanny. She might benefit from getting a job and learning what the real world is like. It would give her time to mature and, after spending a year in a lower-paying job, she may begin to appreciate the wisdom of furthering her education for the financial benefit it brings.
Let me ask you this. Is the real world not relative? So, like, let's say you grew up in money. Like, your parents have money.
Speak to me. This is how I grew up. Yeah.
So the truth is, like, in reality, you may not have to work like another guy who didn't grow up with money.
Yeah.
And never. Like, it may just never be, it never be the case where, like, what, the question is like, what is the, when, where is the real world? Like, whose life is mirrored to say, if you live that guy's life, then you're living in the real world?
I'd say Paul Harvey.
Paul Harvey did not have a normal job. He was a celebrity.
I mean, he seemed pretty straight-laced.
I guess, I was having a conversation with somebody over the last few weeks, and they were upset. In a relationship about someone who's like, you know, the parents provide for them certain things. Like, they work and everything. They have their own place. But their parents are like, you know, they just don't know what it's like to live real life. Their parents buy X or their parents buy Y. And I thought to myself, well, like, I mean, I hear what you're saying. And I value those types of things. And I think it's risky not to do them. But, like, that is her real life. Her parents will actually just provide that type of thing.
Yes.
So, like, what is she supposed to do? Like, what is this person supposed to do? Is they're supposed to say, no, I refuse this?
Yeah, I don't need your car, Dad. I'll buy my own clunker. That doesn't make any sense at all.
I don't know. I mean, like I said, there's a virtue in there somewhere. But, like, I think sometimes we have this way of, like, leveling a playing field where, like, I mean, it's implicitly not level. If I had resources that otherwise could help my children in a way that otherwise didn't turn them blind, right? So it's not destructive, but you would help them if you could. Like, I don't know that I feel like they would have to say, hey, you don't live in the real world because your parents assisted you in ways that otherwise they wanted to and were capable of doing, but that otherwise didn't cause you some sense of entitlement. I don't know. I was just struggling through the thought process because the person was kind of upset about it, and I thought, like, I mean, that's a little unfair. You can't expect someone to actually, like, know how to live in a reality that is not theirs. Their reality is actually different. They grew up differently than that.
Yeah, living in the real world means you live like me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, well, but I live like me.
Yeah, right.
I live in my real world.
It is a bit arrogant to think you are the walking real world. Like, whatever experiences I have is definitely how the world works.
Exactly.
Right, and usually the measure is, if you do not have life as hard as I believe mine was, then you don't know reality. And, like, I think to myself, like, hey, the guys in Zimbabwe, they live real life. I'm like, well, you know, their life is certainly different. And there are probably lessons to learn from that. But that doesn't make my life not real. It doesn't make Dan's life not real because he's got easy access to air conditioning and a comfortable bed here. And so, like, I just wonder if we ought to be a little bit careful about our sense of what creates a decent person in situations like that, because that's kind of what they mean. She's going to go off the rails unless she gets the reality of hard work. Is it possible that this woman's life could be productive and beneficial to society if she, and let's start with the basics here, she loves Jesus, is capable of spending a year doing mission work? I mean, not making a dime,
yeah.
Right? Or, I don't know, working in a political campaign or visiting Europe. I don't care what she does, right? But, like, if you're capable of providing for that, is it not possible that those unique experiences create something that is valuable to the world that I don't have to say, unless you were a garbage man for a year in your off season, you are not doing real work and not valuable?
You know, it is weird because, like, you say that, but, like, as a potential employer, you know, I would be like, man, this person, it's got some experience, right? Like, they did, but they were part of a political campaign, or they did go on a mission trip overseas for like 6 months or something, or like they lived a little bit of life. Like, I mean, when did it become a virtue to say, oh, I see you did what everybody else did for 4 years? You paid big money, you know? Yeah. Okay.
I see you went in the machine and came out.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like high school, right? Except you ain't forced to go. I mean, it's not, I mean, it gives you, I mean, frankly, I mean, there's nothing you can grab at college, you know, that you can't probably find on the internet. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, It's just being exposed to different things. And like, I'm looking at the guy that bit down on one and said, you know what? I'm going to try the Peace Corps and this is what I'm going to do for a year. And then you show up looking for a job and like, you know, let me talk to that guy. He solved actual problems. He didn't whoop out his calculator and have at it for 2 hours in quiet. You know, they're like, hey, Chuck, there's a traveling pirate coming this way, and, you know, we're out of water. What do you want to do? Well, okay. You know? Like, this is a guy that can actually get something done.
Hmm. Okay. All right, interesting. Let's do one more.
Okay, one more. Dear Life from the Path, I've had a weight problem all my life. What makes it harder is that I have a sister a year younger who can't gain a pound. She has always been the, quote, hot one and the center of attention. People she has introduced me to have actually said, I can't believe your sisters, instead of saying, nice to meet you. Of course, my sister is married while I am still single. Okay. I hate being around her because I feel like a slug. Jeez, I'm more physically active than she is, and I eat healthier. I'm not ugly, but I feel that way around her. Do you have any advice on handling this? Okay, speaking of reality, let's just start over, right?
Right.
Your sister in no way contrived how she looks at all. Very similar to how you did not contrive how you look at all, right? So, like, you're starting to understand, it sounds like a little bit, that, like, this is coming from you. It's emanating from you. And, like, whatever onus you're trying to put on your sister, you have got to reel that back in. Like, that's just flat out not fair. You know, she just does not have a choice in the matter. And second of all, you know, well, you know, I don't know. I'm not good at explaining these body things to the ladies, but, yeah, I feel like some of this is preoccupying your time. You know, I'm not saying that looks don't take a part in stuff, but like people love you for the way that you is and the way you are and the way you act and the way you love and the way you carry yourself. And like that blows right by whatever preconceived notions or notches you've knocked yourself down to. Like it's real possible you're the only one that thinks you're there. You know what I'm saying? Other people look at you and they'll say, I can't believe your sister's. Well, apparently you look completely different and apparently you act completely different. She's pretty comfortable in her own skin and you're a drag. You know what I'm saying? You're bummed out about stuff and pissed all the time. Yeah, you're not sisters because you don't act the same. You don't look the same. I don't think that's meant as an insult. It's meant as a, hey, you're just completely different people.
Yeah.
And some of that is because you just ain't happy. And like, man, I can almost just guarantee you put yourself there. And that is not the common perception.
Yeah, I think that's, like one of the things to recognize, I suppose, in that type of situation is that you are, especially when it comes to relationships with someone else, right? Of course, she's married, meaning I'm not. It's very hard for someone to commit to you, and otherwise be in a relationship with you if they only get to be in a relationship with half of you because the other half is always like trying, like upset about not being somebody else, right? So like, you're actually, the thing that otherwise allows you to connect with people and live a full life, that is reflective of the uniqueness of you is being tainted by you worried that you're not somebody else. And so I would say, like, of the things that you want in life, you're probably not ever going to get them if you spend any time at all being preoccupied with who you are not. And so I double down on who you are. You just got to know. You got to know who you are, and you got to leave the comparisons with your sister or whatever behind. And I know that's difficult, but, like, recognize that all things kind of come from, recognize like who you are uniquely created to be, who you uniquely will attract to yourself, and what will be provided to you in reaction to that. So, I found myself giving similar advice to someone who was looking at, they're unsatisfied with their life, and the things that they were like, I feel like I should be doing more in X, Y, and Z, and I feel like I just don't feel energized for some of the things that I'm doing. And I'm like, you know, you're chasing something that's not you. What do you want? What is it that you want to do? What has God built for you to do? What opportunities has He asked you to do? And then go do those things. And like, if you spend any time chasing things that aren't kind of in your line, or like not doing the things that otherwise express who God is, the talents and the uniqueness of what God has created you to be, yeah, you're always going to feel like separated from everything going around you. And so you're just going to have to kind of embrace that thing and start living that life. And then I feel like a lot of that stuff will start to fall into place for you.
Yeah, I mean, Ben, you've spent almost your whole life in the same situation. I feel like,
yeah.
I mean, I feel like people should listen to Ben. I mean, he's got experience here
in the real world.
You know, it's just it's hard to have a sibling who's awesome. It's just hard to wake up in the morning. You know,
That is the deal. Like, I had someone had brought up my eyebrows and said, why can't you have nice, refined eyebrows like your brother Mike?
Yeah.
He's not even my brother, I say.
I know that I wake every morning and I pray, dear Lord, to help Ben to feel worse something today. I mean,
give him eyes for glory.
Give him the
truth is harsh.
Give him warmth when I block the sun. Jeez, secular says, for starters, stop comparing yourself to your sister. You're overdue for reviewing your own assets as an individual. You may not be as metabolically blessed as your slender sister, but that doesn't mean you don't have important qualities that she doesn't share. Figure out what those are, polish them, and you'll discover you're a successful person in your own right. I don't know that you got to drag your sister down there like, well, I got these qualities and you don't have them.
Hey, here's the deal in reality, though. Like, your sister ain't Miss Universe, right? I don't care. Like, it's a relative item. There's probably a million ladies, probably tens of millions of ladies that are better looking than your sister. Grand scheme. Okay? Yeah. So, like, that's not the core issue. As much as you want it to be the core issue, there's 500,000 people that live in the Des Moines metro area as an example, right? And so, if you're having troubles with relationship stuff, it ain't because your sister's going door to door to beat you to everybody. It's not the concept that's actually going on. Like, it really is more of a personal thing. It's you're not really, you don't care about yourself. And you're looking at your sister's an easy scapegoat. And so just, you're going to have to leave her out of this thing and relook at your own life and recognize that you're depriving yourself and others from you completely by kind of dragging that in. That's the thing. It's like, I don't care how good looking she is. There's someone that's better looking. So it can't be the whole story. Yeah. It can't be the deal.
Secular finishes. If you think you're not being married is a drawback, it's time you understood that marriage isn't a goal. It is only a beginning. It is a partnership, hopefully a successful one, but it's not a guarantee of any success in any area.
That was helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, you could buy that at the depressing bookmark store. what was that? What was the intention of that? As long as you're ugly, maybe marriage isn't in the cards?
I don't know.
It's not the answer, I think. It's not.
Right, it's not a fix to the situation.
I don't know.
You haven't arrived when you've gotten married.
Right, but did her, I guess I didn't get that. I got the impression that she was feeling inadequate because it wasn't happening, but like I kind of got the sense that it was just she was saying that is the outcome because of this. Here's all the things in my life that are negatively impacted because of it. Not necessarily like I will become self-actualized once I've married a man.
Right.
Okay. All right. Hey, you've been listening to Life from the Path. Thanks for hanging out with us. If you need some advice, good night. Talk to your church community first. Pray to the Lord. Speak with the people around you. And I mean, if you're not listening to the Lord and the people are failing you, I suppose this would be the next reasonable place so we can point you back to those two arenas. So info@lifefromthepath.org. Shoot us a question. We'd love to be able to help out. And, again, that's hipplevalley.org, to get in on, the Zimbabwe action that Dan was talking about. Check that out. And again, shoot us to info@lifefromthepath.org if you have any questions. You can catch past episodes of the show, including, games, past musical performances, etc., at lifefromthepath.org throughout the week. And you can also sign up for the podcast. Get that audio action in your ear so that we can stream right into your home whenever you see fit without having to take in the visual, because that's the best way to do it. In the meantime, be faithful in the means. God will handle the ends. You've been listening to Live from the Path.